From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1997 when a movie called Selena was released. Selena told the story of the real-life music superstar Selena Quintanilla Perez. Maybe you know the Selena story very well. Maybe you know the music. Selena was a breakthrough talent, taking the music world by storm. And then, before she turned 24, she was shot and killed by one of her superfans. The 1997 film about her life starred an up-and-coming Latina actress in her own right, Jennifer Lopez. And with her casting as Selena, it's been reported that Lopez became the first Latina actress to make $1 million for a film. Lopez said at the time that crossing the $1 million mark was a statement to the world. But she also wondered, how come other Latina actors are not getting the same kinds of chances? Lopez loved playing Selena so much that it inspired her to refocus on her own music career. Within a year, she was starring in movies alongside George Clooney while getting back in the studio to record her own music. And Lopez has said that the progress she was feeling in the late 1990s has not continued on a straight line. She wonders why there aren't more Latina and Latino stars. And that's one of the reasons that the Presente Latin Film Series is bringing Selena back to the big screen in Rochester. That event is happening at the Little Theater tomorrow night. And my guests this hour include Jason Barber, creative director of Presente Latin Film Series, site manager of the International Plaza. Welcome back. Nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to see you.
And Cielo Ornelas McFarlane is with us as well, a visual artist, clerical assistant at the New York State Unified Court System. Cielo, it's great to see you. Thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
Jason reached out a few weeks ago, and we're going to talk about this event that's happening at the Little. But I want to start by asking you about Selena. I was telling our guests that until last night, I had not seen this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer Lopez was a star in the making. She was doing well, but this is what launched her really on this glide path to fame.
Mm-hmm.
Selena herself, the story is so tragic. I mean, it was really hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Why, though, a 1997 movie? Why did you want to bring it back here?
Well, for me, starting this, it's always been Selena. It was the first film as a Latino, I saw myself being represented. And mainly, it was about the duality of us as Latin Americans. The sense of you're an outsider in one world, you're outside in the other.
Mm-hmm.
You are both, you are too American for, you know, your Latino cousins, and, you know, like for me, Cuban, you know, and then you're too Latino for all your American friends. So it's that kind of duality. Remember watching this movie at 15 and I was like, oh, that's me. I feel exactly that feeling. You know, like if I'm in a white community, I am too huggy, kissy, you know, like, you know, too passionate about stuff, you know, too loud. You know, and if I'm in the Latino community, I'm too gringo. I'm the blanquito. You know, so it's like, so it's that kind of sense that she portrayed so perfectly in that movie. That's what gravitated to me. And also, it's because Selena is everywhere. You can't go anywhere without seeing Selena. I've taught in the city schools, and I've seen kids wear Selena. They know her name. I've walked into Trader Joe's with this t-shirt on, and people have stopped me and said, Selena, we love Selena. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. You could be hearing Selena music at Wegmans. You could be hearing it at, like, the, you know, at Latino or any of, you know, at Piron on Clinton. She is everywhere. She's ever present in our community. She's one of those images that have transferred, like Marilyn Monroe, to a greater cultural significance.
I want to explore a couple of the issues that Jason brings up throughout this hour, but there's something in the movie that pops when you describe feeling like there are moments where, you know, you're not enough this or you're too much that.
Mm-hmm.
Early in the film, I think it goes back 1960, 61 maybe, Selena's father, who was a younger boy at the time, was in a music band and very talented singers. But they liked doing, and they were occasionally performing some, you know, very sort of, I don't know, white mainstream hits. They weren't just singing Tejano music. And so there's a scene where they're in a bar and there's a lot of people at this club who want to see Tejano music, and they want to sing these sort of doo-wop hits from the 60s, and the crowd kind of shouts them out, and they said, you know, like, we want to dance. We want Tejano music. And they're going like, well, but we're not singing that. and it gets nasty and people start throwing beer bottles. But that's a moment where they, you know, it's all based on true stories about Selena and her family. Mm-hmm. And that's a moment where you can envision someone feeling like, you know, I'm not enough this and I'm in a community where I'm too much that. And there can be real passion. But what is it like to feel like you're not enough of one thing or too much of another, Jason?
That's a great question. I mean, I know more than once, you know, and you can, you know, this. It's a sense of like, you know, you're when you're amongst like your white friends. And it's Taco Tuesday, good example of this. You know, like, and they're just like, this is how we like tacos, you know? And you're just sitting there going like, well, don't you like spicy food? And I'm like, well, Cubans don't like spicy food. It's not part of our culture. You know, we like salty and sweet, or we like put an adobo. I don't put adobo in. I don't do this. I don't, you know, it's like they know our culture better than we know our culture, or they think they do. Or, you know, like, or in Latino culture, you're the one who doesn't speak enough Spanish. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're saying stuff under your breath, even though you know what exactly they're saying. Like, you know, you're kind of calling them out on it, even though they're speaking Spanish, but you can't speak Spanish back.
Yeah,
them.
I can definitely speak to that, especially because, like, I feel like in the last 5 years, I've just been seeing the phrase and hearing the phrase, no sabo kids, all the time.
Nah,
and, like, that means you don't know Spanish.
Yeah, no sabo.
And even just identifying that that's something we can call ourselves, so we can say we're of Latin descent, but we don't know Spanish. Like, of course, it's meant in a derogatory way, but it's important even then to say, like, oh, yeah, like, this is an explanation. Like, oh, yeah, I'm a no sabo kid. Like, to kind of reclaim something that's a little mean, you know?
Yeah.
Because just because you're a no sabo kid doesn't mean you're not Latin. It doesn't mean you're any lesser. And also, you know, I am of mixed race, so it Same. Goes even more in that area.
Well, there's a moment in the film where Selena, you know, she's 9 or 10 years old and her father is amazed at her singing ability and very proud of her, but he wants her to sing in Spanish and she doesn't know it very well and he wants her to learn it. And I, you know, Cielo, I think, so this is just me being a clumsy interviewer, right? But let me just ask it this way. Is there a difference between grandparents, parents wanting their kids to maintain part of their heritage, their culture, a language? Is there a difference between that and someone who is going to be derisive and making fun of you and casting you out because you're a no sabo kid? Or, you know, I mean, like, do you see kind of nuance there?
I mean, of course, like, my father and his generation, his cousins and everything, their parents they didn't teach them Spanish. And they were very much of the age of identifying as not that we're Mexican, but like we're Hispanic, and really saying like we should assimilate and be part of American culture. So like my father learned Spanish as an adult when he moved to New York City, and his cousin Edward learned Spanish as an adult when he moved to California. So that also is definitely a dynamic that people are aware of in the culture, that, you know, in the mid-century, it was not necessarily thought of as wise to teach your children Spanish. You're going to disadvantage them. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack here, as they say.
Yeah. And similar to mine, my mother's a Cuban refugee. You know, in the Cuban refugee community, you had to learn English. You had to assimilate. You know, like if you came to a Rochester school in 1968, 71, 72, when they were forcibly desegregating all the school districts, and you were Latino, you were in the middle of race riots and fights every single day. And you had to pick a side, a cultural side. You had to say, are you going to be white or are you going to be black? Even though you see yourself as Cuban or Mexican or Guatemalan or Dominican Mexican, you know, like you saw yourself as this cultural ethnic group and not, or Afro-Latino, you know, Afro-Cubano, like, but you had to choose a side in that time. And it affected that generation massively. They had to assimilate to survive in the city, even here. And I witnessed that as a teacher when I was teaching in the city school districts. I saw that all the time with our Latino students. They have to assimilate to survive. Even I had to do that in the suburban schools. You know, you had to negate part of your culture to fit into the greater culture. You know, as a Cuban American at the time of Elian Gonzalez, trust me, I had many kids making rafts and saying, hey, that's the raft your mom came on. Mm-hmm. You know, so like, wow. You know, like, so it was just, you know, and yeah, I have an Anglo name, but it still affects me. So.
Well, and, you know, I'm also curious to know if both of you have experienced, for people who, if you've been in social settings, school settings, whatever, and someone assumes that you're white,
mm-hmm.
and so they are they more free in the way they talk, and then Cielo is nodding very vigorously over there.
I think more now. I think with the way politics is now, they're a little bit more.
Yeah, I was never called anything racially derogatory or, you know, slur adjacent until I moved to Western New York.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Michigan, Texas, New Jersey, New Mexico. And yeah, I never actually experienced firsthand racism until I moved up here. And yeah, there was a time in college that I was thinking of where we were at a house party. And this guy who was a history major started saying some of the most heinous stuff I've ever heard somebody say about Mexicans in real life. And my friend had to forcibly remove me from the situation because I was so mad. And I found out later that he didn't even understand until the next day that I was mad because I am Mexican.
I've had liberal and conservative friends who think they know Cuban politics better than a Cuban, you know, and they'll just argue the, you know, on both sides, like, oh, it's imperialism, is this? And I'm like, it's gray. It's way more complex. You know, so it's and it's hard. Yeah, it's hard for us to kind of like, I think that's for me one of the reasons why I pushed for this film festival. My cousin, who is a film professor, who was a film professor in Cuba, speaks three languages fluently, is an asylum seeker. He had to cross the border in the back of a cargo truck in the last 3 years. He is in the same situation that many people that we hear on the news every day is. And he's a massive film geek. And he, you know, he looked at me and I was at the Eastman House with him. He was flipping out because how awesome it is to be like standing on top of this library of cinema that he talked about for years as a professor, you know. And then we walked past this photograph of an x-ray of one of the cargo trucks that was crossing the border. Mm-hmm. And there's two white little figures in there. And that's the bodies that are coming across the border in the back of those cargo trucks. And his wife looks at it and goes, perfect English. That's us. You know, and that was the one of the main reasons why I, you know, I was like, we have to do something to show that we've been part of this narrative, especially in cinema, since the very beginning of cinema. You know, we've been part of the story. And Selena was the first movie that kind of summed up.
Did you see it when it came out?
I saw it when it came out. I remember seeing a double feature with my one of my mom's friends was Dominican, and she took us out to see like a triple double feature in Pittsburgh Cinema, and we saw that and Shine, the Jeffrey Rush movie, and you know we snuck into one of them, but Selena was like the one we had to go see.
When did you first see Selena, Cielo?
Well, I was too young when it came out, but I don't know when I first saw it. I think probably when I was maybe in middle school. My dad's family is all from San Antonio, Texas, so definitely I grew up like hearing about her from since I was really little. But I'm sure that my dad was like, "Let's wait till she's older, because you know,
yeah,
it's a movie for grown-ups."
That's why we're doing Spy Kids in September. That's for her.
So we're gonna get back to Selena in a second. Let's just make sure you know what's coming up here. So Jason, as the creative director of the Presente Latin Film Series, do you want to tell people what's happening both this week and then what you want them to know about this festival?
Yeah, well, it's more of a film series traditionally.
Yeah.
So we are doing. So what we hope to do is to create a series of films throughout the next few years that kind of highlight Latin voices. You know, Mexican, Tejano, Cuban, Puerto Rican, Dominican, just stories. And I think first off, Selena, and then so for Selena, we are going to have we're having a slight performance beforehand. There will be a food truck at the Little Tamar, and then following it, Roar will be doing a Selena karaoke night. And then with Spy Kids, it's going to be a Sunday matinee on September 29th. It's going to be so we wanted to do, you know, a matinee for kids and for parents and for Gen Zers, because Spy Kids is one of those films that I remember seeing as a 20-year-old and going, whoa, I wish I saw this when I was 10, because this is awesome.
It was awesome.
You know, and it still is awesome. I rewatched it recently. About a week or two ago, and I was sitting there going, like, I can see why I still love this movie. You know, it's just Latin characters, Latin voices, and they're just American. They're Latin American. you know, and they're proud of that. And I think that's why, you know, it's a Latin director, Robert Rodriguez, producer, director, cinematographer, whatever. He did it all. He still does it all. But so I think like that was one of the core reasons we did that. And hopefully next year we're going to try to do Buena Vista Social Club, Mucho, Mucho More, and several other films. But also for one of the reasons I wanted this film series is I want to get the other film series, Image Out and Labor Film Series and Black Film Series, say, hey, it's okay to do Latin films. You know, like there's LGBTQ Latin like stories. There's Black Afro-Latino Black stories. It's everywhere within cinema. And, you know, for the Eastman, just to kind of illustrate, we want Latin cinema at the Dryden. It's something that hasn't been seen that much. You know, Latinos have been part of every aspect of Latin cinema from the very beginning. I mean, Desi Arnaz was the producer for Star Trek and Mission Impossible. He greenlit both those shows. You can literally do a Star Trek marathon and still make it Latino. And you could do Wrath of Khan and double it up because you have Ricardo Montalban.
I didn't know the Desi Arnaz connection.
Yeah, he produced it. He Desi Lu Productions greenlit Star Trek, Mission Impossible, and Untouchables. You can literally have those three movies and say if it wasn't for a Latino, they wouldn't exist.
That is history that I did not know. By the way, the Selena karaoke is where?
At Roar.
And where's Roar?
Roar is over on Culver Road. So it's an LGBTQ nightclub right off of just right near, like on your way towards like Price Right.
And that's happening when?
That will happen directly after the screening of Selena tomorrow.
Okay, so the screening, it's about a two-hour movie. Starts when?
Doors open at 6:30 and movie starts at 7.
At the Little Theater.
At the Little Theater.
And then Roar after. And so when you think about Selena, she'd be 53, 54 mm-hmm. years old today. The super fan, the president of her fan club who shot and killed her, is eligible for parole this coming March. I don't know what's going to happen there. I didn't know how close we were to that possible parole until kind of digging into the story. But it was the way she died, getting shot in the back by a woman who, you know, had apparently embezzled from her family mm-hmm. and kind of betrayed her family, and then cowardly shot and killed Selena. Do you think about what it would be, what she would be today, how big she'd be today?
You know, I was thinking, I don't know if you saw something that Beyonce met her when she was 13.
Oh my God,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. And Beyonce, even to this day, said like, you know, she had an impact on her. She was this big figure in Texas. And here's this little girl from Texas, you know, saying, I want to be like this person.
Wow.
And I think it's so crazy to think about what she started. Because you think right after her, J-Lo, Ricky Martin, Marc mm-hmm. Anthony, Latin voices are statistically, Latin music is worldwide one of the most listened to musics across the world. You can go to Africa and like China and you will hear Shakira. You will hear Marc Anthony. You will hear like these voices. Bad Bunny, all these artists are directly linked to her because she was one of the first people to, you know, and her, I would say her and Gloria Estefan are the two that crossed over to the narrative of saying, hey, you can be this pop sensation and also be 100% proud of your Latin heritage. You know, and I think she would have kind of just been that woman like Gloria is now, kind of just, you know, the cheerleader of that kind of cultural flag. She would have been just carrying that all across everywhere.
What do you think, Cielo?
Yeah, everything Jason just said.
Thanks.
Do you think about someone who was as powerful is not the right word. Well, I mean, fame can be power. Mm-hmm. She's 23 years old. She's selling out, you know, arena. She's in the Astrodome. The world is sort of at her fingertips. And it seems like 30 years later to me, she'd be doing whatever she wants. Yeah. She wanted to be a movie star. She probably would have been a movie star. She could have done whatever kind of music she wanted. She could be retired. She could be absolutely fully active. She could be doing whatever she wanted. And the world was robbed of that.
Yeah.
But I am curious to know for both of you, Selena is so big in sort of your own kind of idea of culture and fame and growing up. How many of your non-Latino friends know as much as you do or feel like they know Selena? Jason?
You know, it's funny. I've had a few friends who I've seen them wear the shirts. They've listened to the music. You know, and an interesting fact that you would love, Selena sold out the Astrodome faster than Michael Jackson did.
What?
Okay? Like, she did 3 nights sold out at the Astrodome. Michael Jackson did 2 and he didn't sell out the second night.
I don't think, until I watched the film last night, yeah. Which opens, by the way, with Selena and the Astrodome, I think I thought she was big. I don't think I was 3, the Astrodome?
Yeah.
Like, really? Wow.
And you should listen to the recording. It's on Spotify. It's nonstop. That band does not break. They go in one song, into the other, into the next. But yeah, I don't know. To get back to your question, I think people, especially if my non-Latino friends, I've seen them listen to music. You know, they play, they'll dance and go bidi bidi bam bam. But I think amongst Latinos, it's just everywhere. I've seen, you know, I work at the Plaza and, you know, we have Puerto Rican vendors, Mexican vendors, you know, and Venezuelan and Colombian and Nicaraguan. And as soon as we put that on, like, the speakers, everyone's just like...
They start moving?
They just start moving. They start dancing, you know? And it's like all of us. So it doesn't matter who we are. We're just dancing to her.
Cielo, how many of your friends who are not Latino know Selena?
I think they know her more as an icon. And, of course, like, the famous image of her in the, like, purple magenta jumpsuit. I think a lot of people really just know of her as an image or an icon and maybe haven't heard the music. But I think that is just kind of a reflection of the insular, you know, cultural differences that we have as Americans, because when I'm thinking about that, I'm like, yeah, and what do I know about, like, famous Black musicians from that same time period? Like, have I ever listened to Whitney Houston, like, a full album? No. But, like, I recognize her voice. I know she's a great artist.
Right.
I know what she looks like. So it's probably, like, the same level for Selena, for other people.
Yeah, and I ask because it's almost 30 years since mm-hmm. she was murdered. And as big as she was at the time, you know, 3 decades later, you know, fame, you know, does what it does. And I think she would have been as big as any of the people you just mentioned. Gosh, question is what happens to that fame over time. So the movie tomorrow, Selena, at the Little Theater, doors open at 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the full story. You can see J-Lo as Selena. I also want to talk a little bit about what J-Lo said at the time and then take a look at what has changed. So, you know, this is the 1990s. J-Lo had been on In Living Color, I think.
She was, like, one of the Fly Girls.
She was one of the Fly Girls on In Living Color. And she had some, I don't say smaller, I guess, I mean, she had some pretty good movie roles in the mid-90s, but she wasn't a superstar. And then Selena happens. And within a year, she's starring next to George Clooney, and, you know, she's, her whole career explodes. But what she said at the time was, as the first Latina actor to be paid $1 million, she said that she felt like it was a statement to the industry. But she also said, why should I be the first? Why was I the first? And where is everybody else?
Yeah.
So she has said over the years, she doesn't feel like it's been a straight line of progress. How do you see it, Jason?
I see it. She's right. She's nailed it perfectly. Cinema, a movie, a representation in cinema has actually gotten, I think, when Selena was made, it was at a better time for Latin representation in cinema than it is now. I think now a lot of actors like J-Lo, John Leguizamo, Eva Longoria, like Eva Mendez, they've started their own production companies. They've said, okay, we have to make more stuff because the studios are not making it. I mean, if you look at, like, Netflix canceled positive, like, representations of Latinos, like, in One Day at a Time, and yet Narcos still survives, you know? And Narcos is, you know, one of the core, and, you know, one of the biggest shows was Griselda, about Latino drug dealers. You know, the cartel image of us has survived. But yet at that time, when Selena was getting made, you had Edward James Olmos and Gregory Nava, who hasn't really made that many movies since Selena, that, you know, were constantly on this row from Stand and Deliver to Zoot Suit to American Me, down to Mi Familia, which was for me one of the first films I remember seeing Latin American, like, our story as part of American culture. You know, and J-Lo, That was her first role. Actually, most of the cast of Selena came from Mi Familia. That, you know, so you see that kind of move into that. And you see actors like Michael Peña say, you know, we're not having the stories that should be here. And it's also just the stories of us as part of the narrative of American life hasn't really happened as much as it should be. And I think that's something I've witnessed in the last few years and I've kind of taken note of is where is those stories? Like, I remember in the 80s seeing movies like Stand and Deliver with Eddie James, you know, like seeing like representations of our community in different ways. But also I've also still watched a lot of white actors play Latinos. You know, I remember a really, you know, like I am Cuban. So the most famous Cuban representation in cinema is Al Pacino. Yeah, that's not a great example of representation, you know, Scarface. So, I mean, and yet you have Cuban actors like Andy Garcia, who one of the highest grossing movies during the pandemic for HBO Max when it first opened was the Latino version, Cuban-American version of Father of the Bride. That was higher grossing movie than the movies that were coming out at the theater at the time. I mean, yes, it was 2021, but that wasn't taken note of. You know, the idea that like, wow, a story with Gloria Estefan, Andy Garcia as proud upper middle class Cuban Americans, are proud of their heritage, you know, doing a remake of it, you know, a movie that was had only had white actors before, Steve Martin and Spencer Tracy, you know, and then having them kind of, you know, showcasing the Hispanic heritage and being proud of it and having part of it in Spanish, you know, having that part of it, you know, seeing coffee con leche is being made in the morning, you know, seeing, you know, someone taking mateva out of the soda, which for us as Latinos, those are those small little details that means the world because that's stuff we grew up on.
How do you feel about Narcos and Cartel and shows like that?
I struggle with that. I remember when they did the remake of One Day at a Time and you have Rita Moreno and you have all these Latin actors and I don't know if you've seen that. See, have you seen One Day at a Time?
No.
So you're going to love it. But it's, you know, it's a cheesy comedy, but it meant the world because, you know, in the morning you're watching Rita Moreno make cafe con leche and cafecito just the way like your mother makes it. You know, you're seeing those small details. And then with with like Narcos, yeah, you got great actors like Diego Luna and, you know, Sofia Vergara and, you know, Pedro Pascal. But even them, they don't like you. They kind of like try to push away from that after that those movies come out because they want to be stronger. They want better examples. You know, I loved Andor because Diego Luna was playing a rebel.
Mexicans in space.
Mexicans in space. You know, kind of being a revolutionary. You know, and that was like, you know, but I think it affects us. There is this Cartel image of us, which again affects the narrative you hear in the press about Latinos. You know, when you're hearing the migrants come over the border, you're hearing the words cartel, you're hearing all those images, and you're hearing us represented in so many different ways. And it's hard for me as a Latino when I hear any, you know, Trump or Vance or anybody talk about us as these people crossing the border, because what is the border? You guys crossed the border first and pushed us all the way back to, you know, the Rio Grande, you know, a bunch of Americans invaded Texas. I know I'm sounding very political, but, you know, it's true. You know, and a bunch, you know, they were a bunch of undocumented Americans crossed the border and, you know, said, hey, Texas is our land.
Yeah, I just have to interrupt because I was just thinking about this. It's like, oh, I better mention Coco because Coco was a great, like, animated children's film with Mexican representation. But I did read several essays from people talking about how messed up it is that there's still a border in the afterlife.
Yeah.
That your papers have to get checked. You can't go back and visit the world of the living on the Day of the Dead if your paperwork's not in order. And it's like, yeah, wow, that is pretty dark. But it's like, okay, but the rest of the movie is great. So we just have to kind of like take that. And of course, like,
our Canto,
you know,
with magical realism. Yeah. Every Latino, we're like leprechauns.
There was good intentions in making that film, of course. They weren't thinking like, oh, and then we'll be so political and like put a border in there. I'm sure it just like naturally came up in the writer's room and nobody stopped to say like, hey, why do we have capitalism in the afterlife? Why do we have a border? Why do we have a border guard.
So I haven't seen the film. I wonder if that's a statement.
No, it's not.
No, that's what I'm saying. It just is quote-unquote normal world building that you naturally take from real life, and you don't pause to think, what are we saying to the children?
I mean,
that there's going to still be, you know, immigration issues when your ancestors are dead. If you don't put them on your ofrenda, they're not going to know. Like, you can think too much about children's
films. This is how Latinos look at film.
Yeah. So I saw Coco in theaters like 5 times. Yeah. So
I liked it. And I cried like a baby at the Abuelita scene.
Every time
I cried.
Let me grab a phone call from Paul in Brighton. Hello, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Great show as usual. And I was thinking one thing. I usually think of more than one, but the conversation that I'm one of the people who have never heard Selena's music. I've heard the story about Selena and understood, you know, the movie and all this the stuff that surrounded it. But I've actually never heard or taken the time to listen. And I just wanted to make a suggestion possibly on future shows along these lines. If you could maybe open up with the show with a little taste of the music, or just kind of set
it. You're already reading our mind. Trust me, the music will be playing the whole time. And people walking in.
And I'm going to see here if I can find a little Selena before we. Rob Braden, who has a very high as an engineer. Thank you very much, Paul. It's a fair question. Rob has a very high bar for sound quality, and I think he may come through the glass and kill me if I try to play Selena through my phone into the microphone. But if we can find some Selena that we can pull.
Do some bitty bitty bum bum.
Bitty bitty bum bum to roll out of here before the end of. We'll do that, Paul. It's a great idea. I mean, you'll find plenty of Selena, and there are whole lists. Anything else we should play besides that? I mean, that's a long list here that I could play here, Paul. But I guess we'll see. Bitty bitty bum bum. You know, Dreaming of You was.
Dreaming of You is, yeah, that's,
you know,
good.
That's the very, in the movie, Dreaming of You would have been what, you know, what the people advising Selena would say the white Europeans would like. Like, this is, and
it's
a crossover hit. She was able to cross over. And I'm sure anyone who was grown up in the 90s or was alive in the 90s and listened to radio, you know Selena. You know Dreaming of You. You know some of these songs. You might not, if you don't know the full Selena story, you might not know, oh, that's Selena. But that's what made her pretty remarkable, is because there was this question at the time, number one, can you cross over? Can you get beyond cultural music, and can you do white European music or mainstream American radio music with big air quotes? But also, could she do it as a woman? Her own father, her own people in her family knew the challenge that she would face, because so many of the stars, the leads of bands at the time, were men. And she was pushing all kinds of boundaries there. And the film details all of that, all the way down to her father being super uncomfortable with her wearing a bustier.
Very Latino father, right?
So that's what you'll see in Selena tomorrow, 7 o'clock at the Little Theater. If you want to see the film, it's a 1997 film starring J Lo as Selena, a beautiful but tragic story. The story of this incredible woman's life that taken from us far too young. And the reason we're here is because Jason Barber and the team at Presente are bringing that to you at the Little tomorrow. He's the creative director of Presente Latin Film Series. And Cielo Ornelas McFarland is also with us. She's a visual artist, among other hats in our community. And we're talking about Latin film. So on the other side of this, our only break, we'll continue with a little bit more of your feedback. And got some other questions on this question of representation and what has changed and what has not changed on screen. We'll come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, an indigenous group in Ecuador says foreign mining practices are harming their land and culture. We'll talk with a representative from that group and members of a local church who've been supporting them throughout the last several years. In our second hour, environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb discusses his book Crossings, exploring how roadways and human infrastructure affect plants, animals, and ecosystems. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Patrick says, I'm no professor of pop culture, but what's the list of actors that made $1 million a movie before J-Lo? It's probably a long list. I could try to dig it up for you, Patrick. But we've been talking about how J-Lo said in 1997 when she played Selena, that you know, she thought it was a statement that she was the first Latina to make $1 million in a movie. And you know, she was not the first actor to make $1 million in a movie. I will tell you that.
No, it was definitely a lot. There was a lot. And I mean, you also have to think about, you know, Rita Moreno didn't make $1 million in a movie. She won an Oscar. You know, like, you have Anthony Quinn never won $1 million in a movie. You know, Martin Sheen, who happens to be what? His name? Ramon Estevez?
Yeah, Estevez.
You know, like, Rita Hayworth didn't make $1 million in a movie. She happens to be Mexican. You know, had to change her name and everything. So the idea that J-Lo had to be the first, and it had to be in the 90s, which was, it's insane. And also to think that how many other Latino actors haven't made a movie since is the hard question. You know, like, that should be, you should see Jimmy Smits. You should be seeing Oscar Isaac, who is making $1 million a movie now, you know, like, and Pedro Pascal. We're finally getting to that image where you're seeing Latin actors and actresses, you know. I mean, we have a Latin Reed Richards. I mean, come on.
Pretty cool. Pretty
that
cool.
is pretty cool. And he's the head of Star Trek. Star Wars, not Star Trek. Oh, my God, I'm going to get killed.
Watch out.
The first, by the way, just trying to do a quick little bit of research for you, Patrick. The first to make $1 million in a film happened in the 1960s, Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando, Cleopatra and Mutiny on the Bounty. So it was roughly 30 years before J-Lo made $1 million for Selena that actors were getting paid that much.
Yeah.
So.
And Edward James Olmos, who had been acting for 30 years before, was the producer of that movie. He's the one who plays Selena's father. And he still didn't even make $1 million a movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would stand and deliver. How many times did you watch that in school? You know?
He plays Abraham, the father?
Yeah.
I think producer Megan Mack was telling me that the guy who played her father had a dual role there.
Yeah.
So.
He's the reason the movie even got made. He's the one who got the Quintanillas to give them the rights over.
Mm-hmm. What is it going to be like next year if the woman who murdered Selena gets paroled? She's up for parole in March. I want to say this. I don't know anything about what she has said over the years. I haven't read. I don't know if this is going to be an instant denial of parole. She shot Selena, and she was the president of the fan club. She ends up managing the boutique, I think. She ends up stealing money from the family. The family confronted her. And then there was a separate... what happens in the movie is a little condensed that you'll see tomorrow night. But what happened in real life, there was multiple interactions in which Selena was even being generous with this woman who ends up killing her. But she just wanted to know, why would you take from our family? And the woman shot her. I can't hardly think of anything more tragic than you're being murdered by the president of your fan club. Some people get obsessed with fame. We know that. Some people have a hard time separating, you know, sort of, there's all kinds of mental health issues that can come with that. But I think I knew that Selena had been killed. I did not know until we went back to this film that it was a woman who killed her and it was the president of her fan club.
Yeah.
So what happens? I mean, it's going to be a big story next year if she gets paroled, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I can't really put into words what will happen. I think, you know, who knows? She won't be paroled. Maybe she'll put, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's so many people who worship Selena in many ways. So I worry. I mean, I do worry for this woman's life. Like, you know, there are people who.
Yeah, she'll need a new identity.
She'll need a new identity.
If she's paroled.
You know, I mean. She'll definitely get a tell-all. I mean,
oh god,
yeah. Or no, she already got a documentary. Yeah,
so. She did.
Yeah, Netflix or something. Was it Netflix?
But when we talk about fame and the decisions that who gets platformed, I do think that maybe you can draw the line at the person who murdered Selena. Like, maybe let's not do, unless there is something really valuable to learn. About mental, CLS, like, no.
No,
I mean, like,
I agree.
Mental health, whatever. You're looking at me like there's
no, no way.
It doesn't outweigh the harm.
It doesn't outweigh. And I think the family's been very vocal about it. You can, like, hear the stories about the family, of what they've said. You know, they don't want her paroled.
So that's how you feel, Sayla. You don't need to see a documentary about the woman who killed
Sayla.
Please.
Okay.
No.
When it comes to Cielo, I know you were you're the resident young on the panel here.
Thank ow.
Well, Jason and I think are roughly the same age.
Yeah, we're about the same
age. And we can relate to seeing films in the 90s.
I saw a lot.
I want to ask you, Cielo, what it is like to see real representation that you can feel seen on screen, and why that still matters. Because inevitably, I every time we have a conversation like this, I get emails from people who say, like, why do we still have to have like a this film series or this day or the,
yes.
I understand the question, but why does it matter to you to feel that representation on screen?
I mean, because it feels great.
Yes, it does.
I mean, like I said, like when Coco came out, which is ostensibly a children's film, like I saw that many, many times in theaters because I was hungry for it. And like a few years before that, like in a fit of self-inflicted rage, I made a New Year's resolution that I was not going to watch any films that were about straight, able-bodied white men. And it was very hard. It was super hard. And then I would get excited. Like I saw at the cinema the movie Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot, which is about a man who is an alcoholic comic artist who was a wheelchair user. And I was like, great, he's disabled. I can see this film. So like, of course, limiting yourself like that is not necessary, but it was definitely a worthwhile thing that I did for a year. And I just wanted to read also these statistics that I've looked up before we got here. From 2023, the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative said that only 5.5% of speaking characters on the big screen are Latino. And this proportion has not significantly changed in the last 16 years, even though the U.S. Latino population has grown by 23% in that same time. And only 4.4% were leads or co-leads in those films. And only 4 U.S.-born Latinos have starred in more than one movie since 2007. So that's the numbers we're talking about here. Yeah. Like, that's crazy.
What would real representation mean to you, Jason?
You know, it was funny when you were talking about Coco. I was thinking about In the Heights. I remember sitting there my white friends, and the first scene, they're making cafe con leches and El Presidente beer is in the bodega. And I just was crying. And they're just looking at me like, why are you crying? And it's like, it's the small details. You know, it's something that matters is those little details, those little stories. And I think we forget how important storytelling is in every aspect of our lives, in every institution, cultural institution. It could be the RPO, the George Eastman House, the MAG. Even here, it matters that our stories are being told, and it's not just the image of us. You know, it's not just our clothes or our food. It's our little details, the little details that matter. It's those little aspects of seeing our abuelitas, you know, the way that they make flan or they make certain dishes on screen, seeing a person of Latin descent like Oscar Isaac or like Pedro Pascal talk in their native language and make like just stuff that you know are part of our day-to-day lives that matter. And I think that's what we want to see in cinema. We want to see Latinos who are proud to be Latinos, and we want to see cultural institutions change that. And I think, you know, as a member of the Latino Roundtable, we did the Latin Agenda in 2016, right before the pandemic. And we looked through all this. And one of the core things we looked at is institutions here need to push that story to the growing Latino population in Rochester. And there's a great man who is the leader within the Latin community here, Eugenio Marin. And he sat down and told me once, he's like, it's not time for us to, you know, go to everybody and say, hey, you need to do this. You need to do this. It is time for you to come to us. It's time for people to say, hey, we want to tell your stories. How do we tell your stories? The DNC did a great job, has done a great job in the last few years of just going to Latin neighborhoods in Rochester and just telling the stories of small businesses. small, you know, the community businesses that are in North Clinton, that are in Joseph Ave, that are in, you know, their barrio, like, you know, like going to the barrio here in Rochester and saying, I want to tell your story. You know, Ibero moved to North Clinton to tell the stories of our people in the center of where our people are. And I think that matters. And that's what I would like to see in representation here in Rochester and greater in film.
That's interesting. You're talking about the authenticity of experience represented on film as opposed to stereotypes, negative stereotypes.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, is there anybody cooler than Oscar Isaac?
No,
he's
not.
He's the coolest
or
dude.
Or Pedro, I mean.
but before we lose the hour, I just want to kind of follow this thread. And this is where it gets a little murky, but like, let's do this. I just want to ask you a little bit more about... So I think that too often the discourse about culture and multiculturalism gets bifurcated. It's like, well, either you assimilate mm-hmm. or you don't, and you don't respect the local culture and language and and the idea of assimilation, it almost sounds like erasure when you actually hear the way some people talk about it. France has struggled with these kind of conversations. A lot of European countries have struggled with it, certainly in the United States. But I feel like it is not just like this talk about a border. There's not like this border between we assimilated and we didn't. Obviously, you want to be able to function and thrive wherever you move and wherever you live. For your friend who came across the border.
That's my cousin, yeah.
For your cousin.
That's my family, yeah.
Your cousin.
Yeah, my cousin, yeah.
You know, sounds like they're going to be great wherever they go. I mean, but they're working on asylum claims, right?
Yeah, and it's right now, New York and Florida only have about 2% approval rate for asylum seekers.
Yeah, I mean,
that's nothing, and you barely can get asylum.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really small number, and it's really under the microscope. So I bring that up because when I hear you talk about what the culinary experiences you have from your childhood and how amazing it is to see that accurately represented on screen. And, you know, is it versus taco night is, you know, compare taco night versus seeing maybe arroz con habichuelas on screen with perfect, you know, like presentation and how differently you'd feel. That doesn't mean that you're like that we can't have this really beautiful multicultural country. Actually, I think that adds to it. I don't think it should threaten us.
No.
But I think sometimes the discourse is really clumsy and it just acts like either you assimilate and you abandon all of, you know, those roots and you suppress that, or you don't and you can't make it work here. And I don't think it's that snug. And I think there's actually something much more beautiful and real in the, you know, about maintaining culture and being part of place. Is that too idealistic, Jason?
I mean, that's a great question. It's hard. I mean, we live in a very complicated time to be Latino in America. You know, we have a man who's running who demonizes us literally on a daily basis and combines us all into one giant collective group as if we're a third race in America, even though we are a diverse ethnicity full of races and cultures and identities and people. And it does. It forces us into this narrative of assimilation. You must assimilate into white culture or black culture or whatever culture you're in to survive and to in a sense, take off your Latino clothes, sorry, your narrative, like your Latino identity to survive in the story. And I want it to be that we are the true mixing spot, like the true melting pot of our country that, you know, I could go to a high-end Latino restaurant in a very fancy place downtown, just like I can go to a high-end Italian-American or French restaurant, you know? Like, I want that to be the narrative. I want to see that. You know, I want to see Mexican food that is not Americanized. I want mixed. I want chorizo. I want not to see another taco joint open up that's like, this is what the Americans like. You know, they like it hot and spicy, you know, and they think, oh, aren't you hot and spicy? You know, like they think that narrative of us. And I want that to go away. I want my white friends to look and say, hey, I'm wrong with this, my view on this. I need to change. I want to go to that Mexican restaurant. I want to drive to North Clinton Ave and get real authentic Puerto Rican, Dominican, and Mexican Colombian food. That's the problem. They're not going to go to North Clinton Ave to get that because they think there's something there, you know? And it's like, yep, they're going to go to someplace on Park Ave and get subpar, you know? Like, sorry.
Inspired. Oh,
I know. I'm controversial. Sorry. I apologize. I'm going to get in a lot of trouble.
I don't think so. I think we're just talking. Yeah. Hey, we got about a minute left. Cielo, do you want to bail him out here? I'm kidding.
I'll bail you out by totally changing the subject. Yes! No, just what you were saying, Evan, is like everything you're saying makes me think about the great solidarity that I feel for Asian Americans.
Yes.
Because so much is similar there in terms of, you know, crying when we see certain foods and, you know, language barriers and divides between generations and that question of is it better to assimilate mm-hmm. or is it better to hold on to your culture? And yeah, it's getting decided on a generational level, on a familial level, right. And it's crazy. And it's like, you know, Asian Americans especially, like that became an identity for political reasons. And I think, you know, the identity of being a Latin American is the same thing. It's more of a political thing. So it's really just about identifying with and celebrating our own unique ethnicities, whether you're Korean, you're Mexican, you're Cuban, you're Japanese, and it's all valuable and it's all part of what makes America so great.
Yeah. As the music plays, I've been instructed that we don't have the Serena music rights. We don't have a lot of rights to music. Which is a real bummer, by the way. I want to respect that, though. And I'll tell you what, go find Selena. Go find Selena. Find it now. You can find it on all kinds of places. And, you know, if you know maybe one or two Selena songs, maybe you just, like, throw a playlist up. Mm-hmm. Because the whole film, Selena, has a lot you're going to see. And it's tomorrow night at the Little. Selena is the movie. Selena is the star who was killed in 1995, played by J-Lo, and the film tomorrow at the Little at 7 p.m. The Presente Latin Film Series. Jason Barber and Cielo Ornelas McFarland, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Have fun with Selena tomorrow. And from the whole team at Connections, thanks for listening. We are back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.